From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Mehmet Toroğlu. He's a broadcaster in VOA's Turkish service, formerly Washington Bureau Chief of the Anatolia News Agency. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Soner Çaptay, author of the new book, The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey. Soner Çaptay is a leading Turkish expert who is the director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He has written extensively on U.S.-Turkish relations, EU-Turkish ties, Turkish domestic politics, and the Kurdish issue. In The New Sultan, Çaptay chronicles the rise of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is now on course to be as influential as the founder and first president of modern Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. The two leaders could not be more different in their orientations and yet used similar tactics in achieving their diametric goals. A product of the late Ottoman Empire, Atatürk was secularist and pro-Western. In his zeal to radically Westernize and Europeanize Turkey, he inadvertently offended and disparaged the more conservative, pious Turks in the heartland. Erdogan has proven to be equally zealous in his attempts, since coming to power in 2002, to dismantle secularism. According to Çaptay, he has flooded Turkey's political and education systems with rigidly conservative Islam and pivoted the country away from Europe and the West. Both Atatürk and Erdogan wanted to change Turkey in their own respective images. We'll talk with Soner Çaptay about Erdogan's early years in power as prime minister when he delivered extraordinary economic growth and helped elevate the majority of the Turkish population to the middle class. When Muslim-majority Turkey, a NATO member and aspiring EU member, exemplified the coexistence of Islam and democracy. We'll examine the factors that led to Erdogan's illiberal turn, replete with crackdowns on any type of dissent from the media, academics, and civil society. Erdogan's increasing authoritarianism has heightened tensions both within and outside the country. And Soner Çaptay is no stranger to these VOA microphones. He is a frequent panelist on Encounter, and we are delighted to welcome him as our PCUSA newsmaker to discuss his new book, The New Sultan. Soner, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me over.
I'm also delighted to welcome my colleague Mehmet Toroğlu from VOA's Turkish service.
Hello, Carol.
Well, Soner, congratulations on
your
book. It's beautifully written. It's a true primer for anybody who wants to know about Turkey, its place in the world. I wanted to ask you what prompted you to write the book now and the significance of the title, The New Sultan.
Of course. I'm really pleased to be here today to discuss my new book, The New Sultan. This is, of course, a work that tracks my scholarship and analysis on Turkey in the last two decades. If you follow my work over time as a scholar of Turkey, I've written extensively on the country and its politics under President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. And in some ways, my current book, The New Sultan, tracks my previous book, The Rise of Turkey, which I wrote about 5 years ago. That was a time of a different political reality. In Turkey, the country was booming economically. It was doing really well. And I wrote a book to say Erdogan has done a great job of transforming Turkey economically. He has lifted so many people out of poverty. He's made Turkey a middle-income economy. I said, now it's time for him also to transform Turkey politically. So to this end, he needs to write a new constitution, which brings together the country's disparate halves, a pious conservative half that loves Erdogan, and the secular half that does not like him, a constitution that would provide freedom of religion for the first half and freedom from religion for the second half. I said in the same constitution, Erdogan would have to provide for broad individual liberties that would help Turkey resolve its Kurdish problem, as well as conflicts with Kurds in Iraq and Syria. I said, of course, a new liberal democratic order would also help Erdogan make Turkey a great power. He made Turkey a middle-income economy. But for Turkey to go to the next stage, to become an advanced economy, it needs to go from making cars, which is its main export now, to becoming a hub for Google. And I said, for Turkey to become a hub for Google, it has to be an open society, a democratic country for which it needs a liberal democratic constitution. I don't think Erdogan read my previous book, so I wrote this one, The New Sultan, in which I look at Turkey's crisis. I argue that Turkey is now in a deep state of crisis, which is driven by his political agenda and trajectory.
Indeed, quickly before I turn to my colleague,
About the title, The New Sultan, I wanted you to expand on that a bit more.
Sure.
Because, you know, the sultans of the Ottoman Empire, at least from my reading, I saw them as more open-minded, notwithstanding some setbacks. They seem more tolerant because the Ottoman Empire, in its heyday, was a beacon to minorities. I remember in 1492, Sultan Bayezid welcomed the Jews fleeing from the Inquisition in Spain. He said famously to Ferdinand and Isabella, "You want to impoverish your country or your land and enrich mine?" And he allowed them in. They were fleeing from persecution. And albeit perhaps always a minority, but they had autonomy and many other minorities. But this Sultan title that you gave, the new Sultan to Erdogan, it seems like a misnomer a bit.
Yes and no. So in some ways, I think Erdogan is trying to revive the Ottoman past because he's seeing his legacy as someone who will finish with Turkey's legacy of 100 years of secularist Kemalism. What is Kemalism? It's the ideology named after modern Turkey's founder, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. It was a secularist political system that ran Turkey for 100 years. Erdogan has completely dismantled this. He's a revolutionary in the social sense. He's trying to restore what he thinks preceded the Kemalist order established by Atatürk. But in this regard, I think he's mistaken. Here's why. All revolutions like to cast what they replace as useless, as backward, so they can justify why they are there and why they are there to stay. And I think Atatürk's revolution cast the Ottomans in a rather negative light. If you look at Atatürk's education system, which was taught to generations of Turks, the Ottomans are depicted generally as the Turkish version of Salafists, backward, completely obsessed with religion, have nothing to do with the West, and therefore a caricaturized version of the Ottomans was taught to generations of Turks. What I argue in The New Sultan is that Erdogan is too the product of the system, where he has internalized and believes in not the real version of the Ottomans, but the caricaturized version of him, taught to him by the Kemalists. So when he's trying to restore the Ottomans, he's not restoring who the Ottomans really were. He's trying to restore the Ottomans taught to him by the Kemalists, this completely obsessed with religion society that is sort of like a Turkish version of Salafism. And I think that is the problem. If Erdogan could go around and realize that the Ottomans were a westernized bunch, that they had secular laws, they educated women, they had, of course, deep ties with Western Europe and European countries as early as 18th century, he, of course, would not be doing everything that he's doing Turkey right now, meaning flooding countries, public and education policies with religion, but he'd be taking stock with the Ottomans and restoring the country's deep ties to the West.
I'd like to turn to my colleague Mehmet Turoğlu for a question.
Yeah, I'm a little bit concerned on your point, because when we look at Turkey's history in the past, it's always been a welcoming country, welcoming culture towards the other cultures.
Correct.
But in recent years, this kind of started to change. When we look at the average Turkish citizens on the streets, the mentality is now very anti-Western, anti-American. Everybody is the enemy of Turkey. In the past, Erdogan said, democracy is a streetcar. It takes you where you need to go, and then you get off. So when we look at, for example, first 5-6 years, Erdogan did achieve the things that no government was able to achieve in the past. Turkey became a candidate to the European Union. So many reforms. These were huge things. But then things started to gradually change.
Correct.
Do you think so? This was a tactic by Erdogan, or do you think he just changed?
It's a great question. So one of the things I argue in my book, The New Sultan, is why Erdogan is doing what he's doing these days. And I conclude in my book that when he was growing up in a secularist Turkey, an order which has completely dismantled in the last 15 years, Erdogan felt profoundly second-class citizen. The schools that he went to, which were set up by the government, publicly funded, were not offering the same kind of educational attainment because they were religious schools as secular schools were. He grew up poor in a working-class neighborhood of Istanbul, so I think socially he felt also second-class. But more importantly, growing up in a strictly secular system in which religion was completely relegated to the private sphere, that was the ideology of secularist Turkey. As a pious citizen, he felt obviously profoundly second-class, and I think part of what Erdogan is this grudge that he built growing up as a teenager. In the first chapters of the book, in The New Sultan, I track his upbringing in Turkey. I also explain a lot of what Erdogan is today through what Erdogan went through in a country where he was most of the time feeling that he was the guy from the other side of the tracks. Now, he came to power in 2002. His party took over. Gradually, he consolidated his power. And I think there are two schools of thought of explaining why Erdogan has gone illiberal. One says that there were inflection points along the road, for example, Turkey's accession to the European Union, which never happened, which also allowed Erdogan to take the military out of politics, and the military in Turkey as a secularist institution was always considered to be the grand arbiter of Turkish politics, an undemocratic one. But to qualify for EU accession talks, Turkish military's role in politics had to be eliminated. Erdogan did that. But then Turkey's accession process collapsed. So that was an inflection point where, had the EU process stayed alive, perhaps Erdogan's illiberal turn after the exit of military would not have taken place. But it has taken place, so that's an inflection point. Other people argue that, and that's something I look at in my book, maybe that Erdogan already had a deep grudge towards the secularist system that treated him as a second-class citizen, that he just wanted to take it down, but he was very methodical about it. He built power first, popularity. He lifted people out of poverty. He built himself a conservative base of mostly new money citizens who are living much better thanks to him and who therefore are supporting him. And that has allowed him to go after democratic checks and balances, media and courts, eliminate separation of powers, and finally be crowned as the country's executive style president after he won the referendum recently. So in some ways, I argue in the new Sultan that Erdogan, even when he's most powerful, still feels like an outsider, that even at the top of his power, when he controls all levers of government, he's intolerant of dissent because he's always afraid that he'll be ousted, which I think explains his authoritarian side that is unfortunately increasingly more and more taking over.
I've heard some supporters of Erdogan and the AK Party say, because of what is perceived as Atatürk's secular fundamentalism, you know, just rejecting any outward symbol of religiosity. I remember, you know, he banned the headscarf, particularly in public places and in universities. No typical fez, which was used. You had to use the westernized hats, Western dress. He denigrated religion. It's almost as if Erdogan is a reaction to this secularization, going completely in the other extreme.
He is, but here's the problem. So Atatürk...
Not that that's good,
the same. Of course. So Atatürk was someone who wanted to shape Turkey in his own image. He wanted to shape Turkey as a country that shared his values as a place that was European, secular, and Western. Erdogan wants to do something similar as a reaction, but he wants to shape Turkey in his own image as a country that's profoundly conservative, politically Islamist, as well as a Middle Eastern society. The problem here is that Atatürk was not a democratically elected leader. He was a general. At that time, Turkey was 90% illiterate in the 1920s and 30s. Most educated Turks supported Atatürk in his agenda. Now, Erdogan has a democratically elected mandate. Only half of the country supports him. Turkey is 97% literate, and most educated Turks do not support him. So it's not sustainable. What Atatürk did cannot be done, not that one is right and one is wrong, given how Turkey is so deeply polarized between two halves, one half that adores Erdogan and the other half that loathes him, given that it's a democracy, given that most educated Turks do not support Erdogan's agenda. His idea of shaping Turkey in his own image as a conservative, Middle Eastern, politically Islamist place is only sustainable for half, completely not sustainable for the other half. And that, I argue in my book, is the crisis of Turkey. It cannot continue in this crisis so long as Erdogan wants to shape the whole country in his own image, because half will never agree to fault under him. And to continue to govern the way he likes, he has to end democracy. And that is more autocracy, which will only be resented more by the half that rejects him, which only, I think, exaggerates in some ways Turkey's crisis and even threatens to pivot to a next, perhaps, and unfortunately, politically violent stage, which, of course, we don't want to see.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest is Soner Çaptay. He's author of The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey. He's also director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a think tank here in Washington. And I'm Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is VOA Turkish broadcaster Mehmet Toroğlu. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA and connect with us on Facebook. Now I'd like to wish a heartfelt Ramadan Kareem to all of our Muslim listeners around the world. We also want to hear from you. What insights have you gleaned from our conversation with Soner Çaptay about Turkey? Write to us at pcusa@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. A quick question about those who do not support Erdogan, right. Soner Çağatay. How united are they, the more secular-oriented Turks,
sure.
And what alternatives do they have? Are there any political leaders in the offing?
Right.
How do they consolidate or regroup?
So opposition's task to challenge Erdogan is a tall order because while when you put them together, they make up half of Turkey, they are very split. And Erdogan has partly accomplished this because of the splits, the accomplishing meaning his consolidation of power. What he has done is he has methodically gone after groups that are not likely to vote for him. He has demonized those groups, brutalized them, cracked down on their rallies, banned their media. And he has always made allies with other groups during his crackdown. So he made alliances with the Kurds when he cracked down on the secularists. And he also used the liberals when he went after the secularists. And then he moved on to the liberals during the Gezi Park rallies of 2013. And then, of course, he moved on to the Kurds. And when he came to the Kurds, of course, all of his other adversaries had already been brutalized and politically disenfranchised by him, that there was nobody to come to the assistance of the last group. So his success was in dividing his opponents, persecuting one while extending old branches to the other, and then methodically moving to the rest. But what he has done is he has won four elections, fair and square. The referendum, there's a lot of people who are suggesting that the vote may have been rigged. We'll never find out, unfortunately, because Erdogan has dismissed all allegations of irregularities. But it doesn't matter. Half of the country that has been brutalized by him, that includes demographics such as leftists, social democrats, liberals, Alevis, who are liberal Muslims, Kurds. When you add them up, you get about half of the country. That half profoundly detests Erdogan because of the fact that he has politically persecuted them in the last 15 years. But they're not united because they're very disparate groups. In this half that opposes him, you have Turkish and Kurdish nationalists, you have seculars and conservatives, center-right and center-left people. Sometimes the gaps between them are wider than the gaps between them and Erdogan. On top of it, the half of Turkey that loves Erdogan has their own quote-unquote Ataturk, a charismatic leader who is trying to shape the country after his own image, and they are lucky because they have their own quote-unquote Ataturk. The anti-Erdogan half of Turkey doesn't have their Ataturk because obviously the real Ataturk is dead. He died in 1938. And until they can get a liberal leader who can unify them, it's going to be a really tall order for that other part of the country to challenge Erdogan.
And we don't want to go to the other extreme again. We need a leader who can meet halfway, acknowledges the religious
completely.
Part of the country as well as the seculars. Let me turn to Mehmet for a question.
Yeah, actually, Turkey is one of the countries, I believe, that the level of polarization is extremely high. It's just black and white. If you're a government supporter, there's no way you can just criticize the government. So the polarization is too high, and this is a dangerous trend. Where will it go from here? Do you expect any kind of implosion? In 2013, thousands of people took to the streets to protest, but then we have never seen Gezi Park again. We have never seen any demonstration. Why? Are people afraid of going out to the streets? Do you think the opposition is too weak or the Erdogan is too strong?
I agree, first of all, that I think we have a high level of polarization in Turkey. I think most societies these days are very polarized, including the U.S. and others. But in Turkey, it's a different kind of polarization because it's built around the personality of a political leader, where half of the country literally worships him and the other half of the country loathes him, and there's increasingly no middle ground. I agree with you, Carol, that Turkey needs to unite its disparate halves. It feels like Turkey went from one extreme, the secularist, to the other extreme, Erdoganist. It needs to come somewhere in the middle. And I still go back to my previous book, The Rise of Turkey. I think for Turkey to rise as a political power after it has done a dramatic job of economic transformation, it needs to bring its two halves together. It needs to have a constitution that provides for freedom of religion and freedom from religion simultaneously. And I think when that constitution happens, of course, then you can talk about the country releasing its energies and becoming a great power. The reason why I'm worried about Turkey's trajectory going forward is because Turkey is not only completely captivated by this domestic crisis where it's split in the middle, but you also have foreign enemies that surround the country. Turkey has a very dangerous foreign policy environment. Its involvement in the Syrian civil war, where it has tried to oust the Assad regime, has failed. But that also has put Turkey at odds with all four of its non-European major neighbors. Those include Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. They have united in intelligence-sharing mechanisms. They're all working to undermine Turkey's strategic goals in Syria. And unfortunately, they're linking to Erdogan's adversaries, the Kurdish groups in Syria, as well as the PKK. And I think that's sort of the potential for political violence coming from outside and threatening Turkey domestically. Then you have the ISIS problem, which is, of course, a direct result of the Syrian civil war. ISIS has been using Turkey, although Turkey is now doing an excellent job of creating border controls. It's used Turkey for a long time to take foreign fighters in and out of Syria, and that has allowed ISIS to both establish networks and also to build a presence in Turkey. We have seen a number of ISIS attacks. So what worries me is not polarization. My worry, as I argue in the New Sultan, is that if Erdogan ends democracy because he cannot continue to govern the way he likes, my worry is that if he ends democracy, then increasingly non-democratic forms of resistance will be seen as legitimate, and that's a recipe for disaster. I hope, of course, Turkey does not go in that route.
Well, you mentioned Kurds on several occasions, and I think we need to acknowledge this very important constituency. At one point, there was even a peace agreement that Erdogan negotiated with the PKK, considered a terror group, but they were going to lay down the arms and negotiate. But this peace deal unraveled. This was very promising. There was an acknowledgement that the Kurds need more autonomy, need to be more integrated in order for them not to be swayed toward these terrorist groups, the PKK. So this is an unfortunate situation. Where is that going in terms of the Kurds' role? And is there any possibility for a rapprochement between Kurds and Erdogan?
First of all, I wanted to join you in wishing our listeners who celebrate Ramadan, Ramadan Kareem. I think it's a great time of the year for that. But to go to your Kurdish question, that's a big part of the puzzle. The Kurds, for a very long time, Erdogan's allies. In fact, they were absent from the liberal Gezi Park rallies when Erdogan cracked down on liberals. They were absent when Erdogan cracked down on secularists in the last decade, locked many of them up. That's because they always thought that Erdogan would give them more rights, and that did not happen, because they came in the way of Erdogan's power consolidation. Here's why. Erdogan's political party, known as Justice and Development Party, has never won more than 50% of the vote in any election. Although it is the most popular party in the country, it always ends up with more seats in the parliament than its share in the vote, because Turkey is a relatively high 10% electoral threshold that bars parties that fail it from the parliament, and it allocates their seats to the first party, which is usually Erdogan's AKP, Justice and Development Party. So that's another inflection point, I argue, in my book, together with the EU accession, that may have helped Erdogan's illiberal turn. His party always had more seats in the parliament than its share in the vote, meaning it had a third of the vote in 2002, two-thirds of the seats in the parliament. It had 40% of the vote, 46% of the vote, always 60, 65% of the seats. So it was always a party that never felt accountable. I called in my book The New Sultan as a party that was on steroids, that always thought that it could do what it wanted to because it didn't feel like it could be bound by legislative checks and balances. And that is his challenge now, because the constitution has changed after the recent referendum, his party is now facing new elections in which it has to win over 50% for Erdogan's power consolidation to continue. But because he can't get to 50% easily, he has decided that he wants to flirt with Turkish nationalist voters who will help his party cross 50% threshold, which explains his hostile attitude towards Kurdish nationalism in the country and also Kurdish movements in Syria and elsewhere. Of course, he's not globally anti-Kurdish. Turkey has really good ties with Iraqi Kurdistan from where it buys oil, but it has really hostile relations with the PKK, which has targeted Turkey with terror attacks in the past, and the PKK Syrian outfit known as People's Protection Forces, also known as YPG. So I think Erdogan, until he wins the next elections in 2019, or if they're earlier, whenever they're held, is going to be on a hostile trajectory regarding the Kurds inside the country, because this is how he thinks he can get Turkish nationalist votes to boost his AKP support.
We talked about these inflection points that perhaps led to this illiberal turn. You talked about slow EU accession talks and now the electoral machinations. But what about the July 2016 coup attempt? To what extent was that an inflection point? Was this an excuse for Erdogan to continue to crack down on his perceived enemies? Was it a true crisis for the country, which it seemed to be? We saw people coming out in the streets from across the political spectrum invoking their patriotism. They didn't necessarily like Erdogan, but they said, no more coups. We cannot have an attack on a president, even if we do not like him.
Absolutely. It was a nefarious attempt because it was an attempt to undermine the political order in Turkey, and it was not really a coup. It was a coup in quotes, in the sense that it was a faction of the military trying to overthrow the other factions of the military and the government, which is why it failed, because it did not have the entire military participate in it. But it was nefarious because it involved killing hundreds of people. The country's capital was bombed by these coup plotters. So the coup, I think, was another inflection point. Until the coup, Erdogan was a gradualist in consolidating power. He was very methodical about it. The coup, I think, changed that perception or threw out gradualist Erdogan and brought in Erdogan that is no more gradualist. So perhaps his fears that he had enemies were ultimately grounded after the coup, because the coup plotters really tried to assassinate him. People were suggesting before the coup that Erdogan mostly acted like a leader who was in a deep state of paranoia. If that was the case, now his paranoia is justified. They really are trying to kill him, and I think that explains his purges. But whereas after the coup, initially the purges targeted members of the what is known as the Gulen movement, which is linked to the coup plotters, and whoever was behind it, Erdogan was justified to go after them. But since the coup, the government in Turkey has arrested 40,000 people. If 40,000 people were involved in a coup, it cannot be a secret. So it suggests that, of course, the persecutions went beyond those who were involved in the coup. So it went from targeting people who were behind the coup to targeting his broader opposition groups. Many people have lost their jobs. 140,000 people have been purged, are no more Gulenists, identified with the Gulen movement, his main opponent. But also people are liberals, seculars, social democrats, and Kurds. So I think maybe the post-coup environment has actually exacerbated Turkey's societal polarization, which I look at in the new Sultan and which deeply worries me.
Indeed. Of course, Fethullah Gulen, a cleric who was a former ally, is here in the United States.
Correct.
And we still do not have any proof, and there's lots of controversy over his potential extradition, and this is going to complicate things.
It's an issue that won't go away. Whether or not Turkey can present evidence that Gulen himself was behind the coup, as you said, he lives in the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania in the U.S. Erdogan and Gulen were allies for over a 10-year period. Together, they took down Turkey's secularist democratic system. Together, they locked up dissidents in the last decade. Together, they took down Turkey's courts and media and checks and balances. Then, once they took down Turkey's secularist democratic system, they each wanted the country for themselves. And what ensued was a raw power struggle. Each one is now the other's eternal enemy, and that's a hatred that will never burn out, of course.
Where do we go from here? Where does Turkey go from here?
I think the coup was a missed opportunity for sure. So a little bit of background, I wrote this book last year, obviously. It was printed in the last few months and recently released. I actually started writing it before the failed coup, and I was finishing it right after the coup, and my publisher asked me to push up the deadline because Turkey became suddenly so linked to the news. I wrote in the first draft that Erdogan had an opportunity to be a unifier after the coup because the country was united behind him. Liberals, seculars, leftists, Kurds, Alevis, they all came out on the streets defending democracy the night of the coup and afterwards. That was a great sign that Turkey had a chance to unify. Erdogan originally looked like a unifier the first few days and weeks after the coup, but very soon he became a polarizing figure again. And soon after, Turkey has once again broken down into two broad camps of pro and anti-Erdogan forces. So where do we go from here? If he continues to end democracy, I think that's really bad news. And there are signs that this could happen. The state of emergency that he put in place after the coup was just extended. He could be extending it indefinitely. Now, half of the country that worships him, the conservative half, had banded around him and will only band more strongly. But the other half that despises him, this very disparate group of opposition movements, they'll never accept to fall under his rule if he ends democracy. And coupled with external actors, Russia and Iran and Assad regime, which will help fund violent groups against Erdogan in Syria and in Turkey, coupled with ISIS attacks, that is a really dangerous and toxic mix. The best case scenario going forward is that I think Turkey remains in the current state of crisis. But there's a fourth trajectory, which I'd love to end with. I call it the thanks to Erdogan, but despite Erdogan trajectory. Thanks to Erdogan because he's made Turkey a middle-class society. It's now 97% literate. So there's a lot of potential in Turkey for a liberal trajectory because of Erdogan. But it will be despite him because that's not where he's taking the country. But that four trajectory, the liberal order, I think is a tall one, because although the potential is there, the energy is there, it doesn't have its charismatic leader to lead that path. And I think until that leader rises up, of course, it looks like the strength of the Erdogan camp is going to be dominant in Turkey. But I wouldn't rule that out. I think that you definitely have a case for a liberal trajectory. And I think that's going to be the title of my next book.
The book is The New Sultan, Erdogan and the Crisis of Modern Turkey, the author and frequent VOA panelist Soner Çağatay. Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Rashad Smith. And joining me on the program was broadcaster in VOA's Turkish service, Mehmet Toroğlu. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.